Hi, my name is Barbara Wangui. I'm from Nairobi, Kenya, and this episode is brought to you by MPW Memberships. Did you know that as a member of MPW, you get access to weekly community feedback on your tracks? This is an excellent resource if you're feeling stuck on how to move forward with your song and need a few pointers to help you finish more music. Get access to this feature and so many more using the link musicproductionforwomen.com/membership.
This is MPW,
the podcast with your host,
Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Danny Senior is a London-based, platinum-selling songwriter, artist, vocal producer, and DJ. She has an extensive discography of vocal features, cult hits, and award-nominated top lines for the likes of Afire, Yolanda Be Cool, Sander Van Dorn, Nora N Pure, and more. Her artist releases have also had multiple primetime plays on BBC Radio 1, as well as features on multiple Spotify playlists. Thank you so much for joining us today on this episode, Danny. How has your day been so far?
Really good. Really busy. And we are in different time zones. So I'm at the end of the day when you're at the start of yours. So I think we're both kind of feeling you're just waking up. Well, maybe you've been up for hours. I don't know. And I'm just ready to go to bed. I'm usually in bed at this time. But it's good. It's been really good. It's just been very busy just working on some songs and just... I mentor a couple of students at BIM as well, so I've been doing that too.
Oh, lovely. Okay, that's good. And before we get into our topic today on writing for artists, can you tell me, how did you get to where you are in your career today, and what was that journey like for you?
My journey really started off as an underground music artist. Basically moved to London because I had answered some auditions that were happening at Husky's Studios in Southeast London. And it was to work with some R&B producers because I had dreamt of being an R&B superstar. I loved R&B, I love soul music, and that's really what I had my mind set on to make. And I got told about some auditions happening in London. At the time, they'd just finished producing Beverly Knight's album, and Beverly Knight is a fantastic R&B singer, and she'd had a big hit at the time called, I think it was Made It Back, and I auditioned for them. I was really young. I was 15 or 16, and then basically... I got through and they decided to work with me, and then that began a period of, I would say, 2 to 3 years of artist development, where I was just basically traveling up from where I lived every weekend and staying with the producers every weekend while we effectively wrote my album. The thing is that they had drafted in songwriters to write for me, which was great. And there were some amazing writers drafted in, including Michelle Escoffrey, who is a fantastic writer and now quite senior at PRS for Music here in the UK, which is our main royalty collection society. So drafted in people like that to write songs for me. But I had spent the summer before writing a huge amount of songs because I knew I wanted to go into music at that stage and had written pretty much an entire album's worth of songs because I just had nothing to do in the summer, basically. And so by the time I had answered these auditions and started working with these producers, I had loads of songs. And that's when they said, oh, you're a songwriter too. And I think that's when the concept of me being a songwriter was really born for me and introduced to me. So I basically started writing my own songs, and together they started releasing them for me on the kind of underground R&B and hip hop scene in London. And I got a really good reception. We wrote some really good songs and we were building. The buzz was building. We had some kind of white label releases, and we had some interviews lined up and lots of radio play. But then we parted separate ways. No big drama. But what had happened is basically there had been a window in which they were going to secure a record deal and hadn't. And at that point, I got really kind of, you know, itchy feet. And unbeknownst to me at the time, I think one of the reasons why it was so difficult was because they were trying to sign all of us as an entire package. I was very young at the time, and I had heard through labels that actually we just wanted to sign you, not the whole, you know, scenario, which was what was being sold. So I think in a way it was good that I parted ways, because I was able to kind of spread my wings and do my own thing. And at that time I had built up a network in London, and there was one particular management company that was putting me in contact with other writers. And basically I just started to do lots of sessions, lots of co-writes. And I also learned from the people around me in terms of the people who were putting out their own music and very much doing it in an entrepreneurial way, you know, just releasing their own music as a DIY artist. And that's when I thought, oh, okay, you know, I can do this. And so really, you know, began kind of putting together an EP and enlisted some producers to work with me on that, and really began to understand the power of gigging. And I was working my social media, and I was doing really PR before I knew what PR was. You know, I was reaching out to magazines and online magazines and blogs and video vloggers and things, and just telling them about me. I was really just promoting myself. I remember at the time I was at university, and I also had a job as a receptionist. So I would go to work as a receptionist between, say, 9 to 12 or something like that. And then I had my lectures in the afternoon, because I'd organized so that I could do both. I'd picked like the subjects to study, which allowed me to work at the same time. So I would turn up to my receptionist job and just literally hustle, you know, while I was on the reception, because it didn't require me to do anything other than be in front of the computer. So I really had that time to reach out to people, and I was building my social media and everything and my presence online, as well as doing gigs and shows. And really it just built up that way, and people began to know of me and what I did and what I was doing. And then eventually, you know, after about 5 years of that really hard graft, that's when I eventually wrote a song that started to get really popular and was played on radio here and was getting a lot of support from DJs like Kiss FM and BBC One Extra and some spot plays on BBC Radio One. And that's when my phone started to ring, really, when I was getting the radio play, because people did already know what I was doing and there was a buzz, but it was just about having that song, just about having that material. So once that had happened, basically I started getting calls from record labels and then calls from publishers. So my professional career started at that moment, I would say, in around about 2010, when I signed my first publishing deal and was actively releasing songs commercially with label backing. But it had really been a grassroots journey. I didn't have any formal music training. I mean, I did music at GCSE, which is kind of before, it's the exams you take at 16. And then I had continued to do vocal lessons and some piano lessons through until the age of 18. But beyond that, I didn't have any kind of, you know, university kind of training in music or music business. So I was really learning on the job and just really built it up from the grassroots and basically broke through that way. At the time when I signed my first publishing deal and record deal, I was unmanaged. So I was managing everything myself. Obviously, you know, once deals came on the table, I mean, people had been interested in managing me up until that point. And I had a few people that came in and out, but nothing solid. And then once I was actually writing and then writing for more established artists, that's when someone said to me, oh, well, what about, you know, you should get a manager. And then I said, OK, maybe I should get a manager. Maybe I should. And then that's when I sought a specific kind of songwriter manager at the time, because I had, you know, very much fallen into writing songs. I just signed my first publishing deal, as I said, and then they open up this whole world of songwriting. And one of my first hits was with Jolyn Tesai, who is kind of Cantopop's version of Kylie Minogue, certainly was back then. She was a huge megastar, and the song that I wrote for her became a really big hit for her. It was called Honey Trap, and it was a number one selling single. And then her album, Myself, I think was a number three, top five. And then she won a music video award for the song as well. So it became really successful, and that began a kind of snowball of opportunities and co-writes.
Mm. I love that. And there's so many things about that I would love to go into more detail in. But you were kind of saying from the start to the point where you signed that first publishing deal, where in your eyes, that's where your professional career really started. Can you tell me how long was that period? Because I think for a lot of people in this industry, they feel like, oh, you know, they're working really hard and things aren't happening and they're getting frustrated. So, yeah, do you know roughly how long that was?
From when I first started to when I got my first deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going back to what you said before, I tried to condense that whole experience in, you know, 2-3 minutes, maybe it was longer, but, you know, it really, so much happened during that time. And I could speak for hours about my A to Z. You know, there's no real kind of straightforward answer because there were so many factors involved. But yeah, I mean, the journey took, I would say, I mean, I started recording and writing and developing from the age of 16. And then I would say, I think the record deal came when I was 24. So that is 8 years. That's 8 years of recording, writing, obviously a false start with the production company I was working with. As great as they were and as grateful as I am to, you know, have had that opportunity to develop with them, it certainly wasn't the right package at the time for me in order to move forward. So then coming out of that and finding a new situation and effectively kind of start, not really starting over again, but finding a new crew and finding a new team. Yeah, it took a couple of false starts and a good few years, so 8 years. So this is why I always say to people, you know, don't worry about, you know, not achieving things in a year or two, because it rarely works out that way.
Definitely. And, you know, you mentioned false starts and things, but that just seems like such a natural part of anyone's journey in the music industry. Like, of all the people I've spoken to, it seems, I don't know if I have spoken to one person where it's been like a clear progression. So that just seems so natural to kind of try one thing, maybe that doesn't work out perfectly, move to the other. And I think it's really important to mention that it took 8 years, because for the people that are hustling and, you know, a year later, they're like, oh my gosh, this hasn't happened for me, to really realize that this is a marathon. And we talk about this a lot, and not a sprint, but for people to really be aware of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can be disheartening when you feel like you're not getting anywhere in the prescribed time that you've given yourself to achieve it. But it does take a while, and it can take a while. Don't get me wrong. It can happen overnight for some people too. And you can get very lucky. And, you know, TV shows are a prime example of that, you know, having that platform to kind of launch from, particularly when X Factor and Pop Idol were popular and happening at the time. That's really an example of overnight success. But, you know, for the rest of us who are doing it in a reasonably traditional route, yeah, you know, it takes time. It takes time to develop, to build your craft, and to learn lessons and take those with you and then, you know, learn from those experiences.
For sure. And do you have any words of wisdom to keep your enthusiasm and motivation in those times where you're like, oh, you know, this is taking longer than I expected?
I would just really say that it's okay to don't compare yourself to other people, basically. It's okay to be in your own lane and have your own path of development and progression, because everybody, as cliched as this sounds, everybody is on their own journey and everybody has things to learn while they're on that journey. So I would say just keep on going. Also remember that there are key things that you can be doing to achieve success faster. For example, just good habits, consistency, working hard, doing something almost daily. Give yourself a break, you know, maybe a day off or two a week, but, you know, working on your music daily, just doing something that helps you move towards your goal, because it's the big wins are about the small steps. But just being consistent with that and persistent, and also an element of fearlessness, all of those things combined, but also having the faith and having the patience and not doubting your ability. So some of us doubt our abilities and ourselves when things aren't going according to our timelines, but it's never personal. It's nothing to do with our abilities. It's just that it's not the right time yet, or you haven't met the right team, or you haven't had the perfect opportunity for you. So I would say a combination of those things, really.
So many gems.
I had to think about that one for a minute.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. No, lots of things there to think about for us. So thank you for going into that. And can you tell me a random fact about yourself that maybe not that many people in the industry know about you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think many people know this about me, to be honest. It's nothing to do with music or anything like that, but I have never tasted or eaten seafood or fish.
Okay. You know what? I'm the same. But
really?
Yeah. Well, I grew up vegetarian, and there are lots of meats that I've never tasted. So some people may not put fish in that category, but that's what happened with me. But that's probably a different story to you.
Well, I mean, not all, it's pretty much the same. I've been a vegetarian for longer than I have not been a vegetarian.
Okay.
So I think me not eating fish and just being completely terrified of seeing, you know, pretty much what I considered corpses on a plate, because, you know, you get served that as if you can see a full, you know, fish on a plate and it's got skin and eyes and things.
Yeah.
And I, that just used to really frighten me. And I just couldn't understand why we ate that. And so, yeah, my mother used to try and get me to eat it, but I had this technique where I put my napkin on my lap and would, you know, put the food on my fork, but then at the last minute, drop it my lap on the napkin, because we weren't allowed to leave the table unless we'd eaten everything on our plates. So I had to, you know, I had to basically have this kind of heist going on where I'm like dropping it in my lap and then folding it up and asking to go to the loo so I can basically flush it down the loo and pretend like I've eaten it all. But yeah, so, you know, that was, I think, a sign of things to come, because as I said before, I'm a vegetarian and have been for most of my life now. So yeah, I don't think many people would know that about the fish story, but no. That's interesting that you haven't.
Yeah.
You know, you've been, presumably you've been raised a
yes.
vegetarian then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've only ever had a McDonald's McChicken burger is what I had.
Oh.
So yeah, anyway, that's back to 16-year-old days, and I won't go into that for the moment. But getting into writing.
I'm intrigued.
I'll tell you that after the episode. But
okay.
Getting into writing for other artists, one of the many skills that you have, as you mentioned, is writing for other artists. And it seems like such a variety of artists as well. You know, lots of artists in different genres, also in K-pop, J-pop as well. And can you tell me, how does this process usually start? Is it that you pitch a song to an artist? Does that happen through the publishing company? Just a bit of a idea around the process.
Yeah. There are so many different ways. When I first started writing songs, I just wrote songs with nobody in mind for them. And then I have actually pretty much pitched the majority of my material since I've been writing, and managed to secure a lot of releases and cuts just by contacting people directly and saying, hey, I've got a song, you know, for your artist or for you. I'd love you to hear it. But I in the beginning, I would just write the songs, because pitching to me and reaching out to people was alien. So, but then seeing my publisher do it, I very much quickly learned that if you've got the network, then you can access the people that you want to send the songs to. So I began answering briefs. So I'm sure you know, but you know, when you sign to a publishing company, they will let you know about who's looking. They've got these things called who's looking lists, where, you know, it lists all the artists globally around the world signed to different record labels, and it will tell you what these artists are looking for, whether they're looking for an up-tempo R&B track or a house track or an EDM track or, you know, whatever. And then you will busy get to work and write song to brief. So there was a bit of that going on as well. I would specifically write to brief. But to be honest with you, I found that I had less success with that, because I would often just make really bad carbon copies of what they were looking for. But that, I think, was an inexperienced thing. As you get more experience, you learn that, okay, you know, songs that eventually get cut and get placed with artists are songs that they're looking for, so does match the brief, but also contains, you know, it's got to be a great song and contain, you know, semblance of a commercial formula if that's what they're looking for. But it also needs to emotionally connect as well. And I think when you're writing songs just because you're just in the zone, it's a very natural thing to make it emotionally connect with people, or it should be. But when you're writing songs for brief, to a brief, it can feel forced and it can come across as fabricated and not real. And I think audiences very much are savvy, and they know when things aren't authentic and when they're not real. So yeah, I would say, you know, I began a mixture of just contacting, reaching out to labels, sometimes even the artists direct. So I'd find out, you know, who the artists were signed to in terms of the labels, or find out who managed them or who was their A&R, and just get in contact with them. Whether that I tracked down their email address, if I knew where they worked, I'd try and guess what their email address was, or find them on LinkedIn. A lot of people are on LinkedIn now. But yeah, there was also briefs coming through from my publishers, and what I would do is go through my catalogue of songs and say, yeah, that will work for them. But also, you know, what I do now is, I think a big part of being able to pitch and get cuts successfully is having an overview of the music industry landscape, and just knowing, you know, looking at the charts, which is what I do, look at the charts in different countries and the main territories that I want to, you know, work in, and always checking new music. I'm so all over new music pretty much all the time, just, you know, always checking out new artists and things, so that I can try and actually work with them and build relationships with them from early on, which is how the whole Shensia cut or release came to be. Shensia is now a global Jamaican reggae dancehall artist, and has had some major collaborations with, I think she even did one with Megan Thee Stallion, Lick. And then she did one with Tiger as well called Blessed, which I absolutely love. So, but I worked with her very, very much early on in her career, and she was just building at that time. So yeah, just a number of techniques really. And now, I mean, most of the time I'll either work directly with the A&R, which is what I'm doing at the moment. I'm working with an A&R specifically for a project in the States, where we're kind of trying to create bespoke songs that the artist will like, or just go into artist sessions with the artist to build something that they're immediately happy with, you know, in the room. You'll get a real sense of whether they love the song or not, you know, by the end of the session.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Also pitching as well. Also just what I call cold pitching and sending my songs out. So I do a number of those things, but it really is about, you know, keeping that frequency up. And I don't really rely on, I don't wait for things to happen for me.
That's
put
great.
It that way.
Yeah,
I'm quite quite enterprising in that way and always have been. And I think that is really important to be and to do, you know, to remember that even when you sign to a publishing company or a record label or even a management company, nobody is really going to care about your career as much as you do, unless you're extremely, you know, blessed and lucky and you've got someone who's been with you from the beginning, you know, and is as passionate about your career as you are, in that kind of, you know, dynamic duo way, like, I don't know, Shalitzi and Marshmello, you know, those guys working together to help build Marshmello's career. But yeah, so that, just a little piece of advice there. You didn't ask me for it, sorry, it's completely unsolicited, but there you go. I thought it might be something.
No, it's really, really helpful. And on that, and you've kind of touched on that as well, like, don't rely on your publisher as well, and, you know, don't rely on anyone, and just keep hustling yourself as well. Do you think for those that don't have a publisher, it's possible for you to start doing this yourself by pitching, you know, on your own?
Absolutely. Just go for it. I think all you need is a pitching strategy. You need to first have your catalogue of songs, and then you need to kind of identify, okay, where do you want to be? What pocket do you want to be in? You know, what territory do you want to be in? And then make it really focused. Make it really focused and just focus on that, you know, for a short time or until however long it takes for you to get an in, get a contact, and then really nurture those relationships with the contacts you make. But absolutely, you don't need a publisher. What you do need, though, is a network. So this is why, you know, networking is really key, and I can't recommend it enough. I mean, my network has I've built it up over the years, and not really intentionally, but I guess I've just had that personality where I've not been too anxious or afraid to make new friends and just put myself out there. You know, I've been pretty fearless in that respect, and sometimes a little bit too fearless, you know, banging down doors when I could be knocking politely. But sometimes, you know, that's what it takes to get noticed and to get seen and to get heard. So building your network. And then once you've got your network, you don't necessarily need a publisher, you know. You definitely will need a publisher to admin and collect your royalties, or some kind of organization to help you do that. That might be beneficial to you. But you can definitely get things going yourself. I think publishers do, good ones, good publishers, and I emphasize the word good because there are many bad publishers out there that, you know, aren't very good and aren't very active. But good, active music publishing companies should be setting you up with sessions, should be managing your registrations correctly, should be sorting out your splits, should be developing you as a writer, should be setting up songwriting camps, should have a studio that you can work in. You know, there's some publishers out there that don't. And, you know, just basically be there to try and support and facilitate your career as much as possible. If you haven't found a publisher that does that for you and you're finding that you're doing quite a lot of stuff on your own, then keep on building your value and keep on, you know, leveraging that enterprising spirit to your benefit, so that when you eventually do get offered a deal, you'll be in a far stronger position to negotiate terms. So a publisher is not the be-all and end-all. And I know many people who have come out of their publishing deals and taken a big break, you know, for a while, sometimes up to 5 years, built their catalogue back up again, you know, started to put out new material with new artists, and then waited to sign a publishing deal. I actually got told a story the other night about someone who had waited compared to someone who hadn't waited. Together they collaborated on a song, and it ended up being a really big hit in Canada. And basically, the person who hadn't waited signed an American publishing deal for $30,000, and then the person that had waited and the song, you know, blew up, ended up signing a publishing deal for $2 million. You know, dollars, which is a huge, and to top it all off, I got told that the person who got the $2 million came from a really wealthy family, to add insult to injury, whereas the other person who got the $30,000 was poor struggling songwriter. Yeah, so, you know, I think, you know, if you don't need the advance, don't take it. There's so many factors to consider in publishing deals, and I can talk about this for hours, but, you know, that's a whole other topic, and I don't know if we're ready to go there quite yet.
I feel like we'll need to get you back, Danny, for a few other topics. But sure. No, that's so many things to think about there. And one thing that you mentioned on before you pitch to have a catalogue of songs, can you tell me a little bit about that? Like, what kind of songs would you be putting together? Is it like a variety of songs, or is it songs that are quite similar? And also, what format are they in? Are they just kind of a cappella, you know, lyrics and melody, or are they, you know, fully fledged out productions? Are you doing them yourself?
Really, really good question. So there was so much. Let me see if I can remember all of them. So going back to the first one, the catalogue, what makes a good catalogue and different genres. Honestly, I think you have to do what speaks to you, because if you're a singer-songwritery type and you love making acoustic-driven music and you're not experienced in other genres, then just stick to that and just, you know, work with your strengths and just get an amazing body of songs. There's a lot to be said for coherency in style. So you haven't got to be, you know, a jack of all trades. You can focus on one style if you like and, you know, be an acoustic-led singer-songwritery type. It just so happened that I had experimented and worked in many different genres just because of my musical taste as well. I've grown up consuming a lot of different music. So I was able to kind of dive into different genres, and I had an understanding of different genres as well. And I had the opportunities to work in different genres, to work in K-pop and J-pop and then dance and R&B and hip-hop and pop. Those were opportunities that had popped up. And I just thought, okay, yeah, I'll give it a go. I'll come out of my comfort zone. So I don't think it really matters whether it needs to be a big, broad range of genres. They just need to be great songs. Arguably, if you write a good song and you've got a good idea of what, you know, a song structure is and what a good commercial, if you're aiming for commercial market, what a good, you know, commercially viable song is. If you've got an idea of that structure and what's expected, then, you know, you could write a song that could translate to different genres. It could start off as a ballad and then be picked up by Swedish House Mafia and be turned into an EDM track, which, you know, has happened a few times. So in terms of the kind of difference, you know, quality of demos, I have songs in my catalogue that are voice notes. I have full productions. I have emailed a voice note and pitched a voice note. I've pitched just a piano line and a one lead line, and I've got that cut before. And or equally, I've pitched full productions. So I, you know, there's no hard and fast rule on this. It's really about the vibe and the song quality as well. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to have amazing, you know, finished productions in your catalogue. You just need something that gets your idea across. I mean, in terms of, you know, if you're going for kind of A-list artists, then you'd want it to have some semblance of, you know, good sonics. But even then, the song will always trump, you know, will always come through. So I think just getting them, me personally, I like to get my demos to a point of good quality where, you know, you can almost hear them on the radio. That's what I prefer to do. And that's what I do, you know, that's how I present my demos mostly. So the vocal production will be, you know, really well produced. I do all of my own vocal production and I really spend a really long time getting that right and getting the vocal arrangements right and, you know, tweaking the lyrics and tweaking the vocal arrangements. In terms of production, I wouldn't call myself an accomplished producer by any means. I can do enough to get an idea down and I can definitely create beds and chord beds and percussion and just basically skeletons of production. But in terms of getting that real professional sound, I will work with other producers who are far more experienced and far better at that than I am. My skill set really resides in top lines, melody, lyrics, vocal arrangement, vocal production, song structure, and just having a sense of, you know, kind of bringing that commercial element to the room in a way. So yeah, I mean, you know, I hopefully that answers the question. Just to kind of summarize it, I do think it is, you know, for me personally, I do like to get my demos to a point of sounding, you know, professional. And I think you really can blow people away if you have a maybe three or four just absolute monsters that sound great sonically, are great songs, you know, and good production. And then, you know, acapellas are great as well, by the way. I really recommend just keeping on to your acapellas, particularly if you record yourself, because they can be pitched to other people. You can build new productions around them. So I have numerous acapellas in my catalogue too, and they're really handy, particularly for pitching to DJs and producers in the EDM, dance music, electronic house music scene.
Awesome. And so you mentioned kind of it can be different styles of music or one, if that's what you feel comfortable with, and there can be a variety of levels of them being finished tracks, as some from voice notes to full productions as well. And then with the catalogues, how many songs would you ideally pitch? Is there a number, or do you not want to overwhelm them with too many ideas, or would you pitch one?
To a specific artist?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really good question. I think what you don't want to do is send 10 average tracks, because if they go through those 10 average tracks, they might just write you off and say, okay, that's an average writer. At least if you send one average track, they might say, oh, what else have you got? So I think sometimes just erring on the side of caution in terms of quantity is a good thing. It's funny because I just pitched to ITZY recently and I sent their A&R. I sent their A&R 5 songs. But I also pitched to Tiësto, but that was because I had written a song that I felt would be perfect for him. So it's usually between 1 and 5, but I don't think I would go beyond that, to be honest with you. I would just kind of leave the door open a bit for them to say, okay, what else have you got? Unless they've asked me for lots of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's helpful to have as a bit of a guide as well. So if you are starting out, and you did talk a little bit about this, and you've got the songs ready to be pitched, you know who you want to pitch it to, do you have any tips on finding the right email to pitch to?
Yeah, I do this all the time, actually. I'm actively doing this as we speak. I have a full-on, you know, pitch strategy with a spreadsheet, the whole shebang. But I mean, a good trick is, you know, if you know what company they work at, if they work at Universal Music, then usually the email address will be their first name at universalmusic.com. Or, you know, you'll find someone else's email and then you can piece together the puzzle. Oh, it's their name dot the surname. Or just finding them on LinkedIn and just reaching out. I'm a big fan of just, you know, just contact them and ask them, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So, you know, you can send direct messages and DMs to people on LinkedIn, and I don't think you've got to, as long as you're connected, I think. But yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of A&Rs on LinkedIn and obviously Instagram. So, but another way is just checking out the artist page and on Instagram. Most of the time they've got some kind of contact email there, or just using your network. You know, there is always, I really do think that you can't access anyone, because someone in your network will know someone who will know someone. So, you know, asking around as well, and asking people who aren't like gatekeeping the email addresses, you know, preferably is good. People who are willing to share the contacts, because, you know, from their perspective, they might say, well, I've spent years building up these contacts. Why am I just going to hand it over to you? You know, but those would be my three methods and recommendations, really. Yeah, I wouldn't ever do, I don't recommend people or like aspiring songwriters email, you know, info at, because it shows that you have, I mean, it's quite revealing, you know, because you can track down someone's email address or their LinkedIn. And if you've just gone through the info channel, it kind of begs the question, okay, how much effort have you put into this to get to me, kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have a tip on finding the team of that artist if it's not explicitly on their page? For example, finding who their manager is or the A&R is.
Yeah, I do. I think what I've done in the past is just find out what label they're on. That's always a good start, finding out the label that they're on. And then that will immediately give you a doorway to an A&R there. That's one way. I think managers, if they're under the radar, if they're not on social media, can be tricky. But most people are on social media now. And most people talk about the artists that they're managing, or it will be somewhere in some article or some music week, you know, in Music Week or another, or Billboard, or, you know, another big music publication, Hits Daily Double, it will be spoken about. So sometimes these things are just a Google away and just a bit of investigative work.
Okay, no, that's great. And of course, you have developed your songwriting skills in so many different genres, and you mentioned you weren't trained in university or anything for that. Can you tell me a little bit about how did you go about honing your songwriting skills and any tips that you might have for those starting out in this space?
Yeah, sure. The first steps for me were really just consuming and listening to music. And I would study the song structures and get quite nerdy about it and look at the lyrics. The lyrics, for me, if I read the lyrics on the page as I'm listening to the music, then I'm very quickly able to see where the patterns of repetition are. And being a I studied English literature at university instead of music, so I'm a words person. I love words, I love reading. So looking at the lyrics helped me understand how songs are structured, because I'd see certain sections repeated. I remember doing that, you know, looking at songs from really 13 onwards and just, you know, knowing who had written the songs. I'd always look at the credits, I'd always, you know, try and discover who the writers were. And I was always interested in that aspect of it. So I was kind of inadvertently studying songs and really kind of, when it came to the point of being able to, having an opportunity to write songs, I just literally copied. I just emulated. I just imitated what I'd, you know, seen. I just copied the songs that I'd heard in terms of the structure. I figured out that, oh, okay, there's a section that's a verse, and then there's usually another section called a pre-chorus and a bridge, which leads to the chorus. And I didn't know the terminology for these things until I actually got in the studio and started working with producers, and they would say things like a pre-chorus or a middle eight. And then I would say, oh, okay, that's what that is. For me, I was just kind of learning by listening. Obviously, you know, on my journey as a songwriter, a big part of my development has been collaboration, learning from other people when I've been working with them and learning their techniques. And that really has been instrumental and absolutely, you know, such a springboard for me in terms of developing my songwriting, seeing how other people work. So collaboration is always good. And then obviously books. There's so many different books out there about songwriting, how to write better lyrics, and The Song Machine, which talks about, you know, kind of commercial top lines and how they are built and written. So just reading lots of books on the subject and also listening to people. There's lots of brilliant interviews on YouTube, you know, from people who do these kind of ASCAP interviews. In fact, I found one, actually it was given to me ages ago, about how E.T. by Katy Perry had been written and the vocal production, how that, you know, had been created. So just all of those things, really. It's still a study and it's still a craft for me even now, because music changes and changes with time and over years. So it's always a learning and a relearning process.
We are now at our speed quiz. Are you ready for that?
Oh my God, I don't know. I'm getting a bit nervous now. I felt my heart go, woo! Okay, go on then, hit me.
All right, so five quick fire this or that question. The first one that pops into your mind. So, oceans or mountains?
Ooh, oceans.
Roller coasters or water slides?
Water slides.
Headphones or speakers?
Headphones.
Festival or rave?
Rave.
Mac or PC?
100% Mac. Yeah. Sorry, PC lovers.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I think it was the first one where we almost caught you, but good job. Now, coming to our top tips, and you've shared so many already, but what is your one top career tip?
one top career tip for me would be to remember that personal development and working on yourself is equally as important as professional development. People that I mentor and speak to about this probably hear me say this all the time, so this will be nothing new, but I think that in order to sustain your professional career, you need to have done the work on a personal level. And what I mean by that is, for example, on, you know, taking a light example, if you're going in the studio and you're collaborating with someone and your communication isn't as good as it could be, and you end up getting frustrated because your ideas aren't coming across, and then that studio session, you know, somehow begins to feel uncomfortable, then that might be a scenario that you could, not to put any pressure on anyone, could go take a bad turn, and you may not have that opportunity again. Whereas, you know, coming out of that is fine. People make mistakes. We all learn. We've all been in those situations. But stepping away from that and just reflecting on it and just saying, okay, what went wrong? What do I need to resolve? Okay, maybe I need to, you know, figure out better ways to communicate my ideas with people so that I'm not, you know, kind of ramming my ideas down people's throats, or they feel compelled to take my ideas on board rather than, you know, steamrolled with my ideas. And maybe I need to kind of learn how to regulate my emotions. I think you can sustain your success for a far, you know, longer and authentic period if you have, you know, done that self-development work as well. And another example on the opposite end of the scale would be, you know, say you are using alcohol to numb your anxiety when you walk into social situations, which I have done, you know, and I know many people who have done that. If you're going to a networking party event and you know, the stakes are high and you've got to be on and you've got to be this amazing, you know, person that's engaging and funny and all the rest of it, sometimes you might need some Dutch courage, but that can be a downward spiral if you end up doing it too much and relying on it. So getting to the crux of why that's happening, why do I need that to get through this networking event? And what do I need? What other coping strategies can I develop that are a lot more healthier than that?
Yeah, definitely all about the personal development. So I completely agree on that. And what is your one top self-care tip?
Schedule in your self-care like it's a job to do. Otherwise, it is so easy to say, I don't have time. And I can't claim credit for that one. I got that from my best friend, Georgie. She was like, you've got to schedule it in. You've got to schedule the gym in. So there you go. So yes, scheduling in my, you know, meditation and my affirmations and my yoga and my walks, you know, during lunchtime or whenever I'm taking a break are part of my work. It's you know, it's putting me in that state to be able to receive ideas and inspiration.
Love that. I started doing that last year and that's changed my life for sure.
Amazing.
Yeah. So no, that's good. And what is your one top general life tip?
I did think about this before we got on the call. I was like, what's my top general life tip? And now it's completely gone out of my head. So I'm just going to have to freestyle this. Mm-hmm. Top general life tip. I would say, try not to look back on things that haven't gone your way with regret. Look back on it to reflect, because everything that you go through that might be a challenge or an obstacle or something you wish you had done better is actually preparing you for your future self. It's giving you, you know, that experience to be able to make a success of it next time. So I would say, only look back at the past to reflect and learn from it rather than to dwell on it.
Oh, that's a great thing to reel off the top of your head, Dani. So love that and so useful.
Why, thank you.
So thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure and I know I have gotten a lot from this episode. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
And thank you so much to you as well for giving this platform to producers and for me, you know, to talk about these things. I've been such a fan of what you guys have been doing for so long. So I was so excited, you know, to actually be interviewed by you. Oh. I just think what you're doing is brilliant. So thank you to you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My biggest three takeaways from the episode with Danny were firstly, that you don't have to be the jack of all trades when it comes to songwriting. You can focus on what you are good at and pitch for songs that are within that genre. My second biggest takeaway was that no one will care about your music as much as you do. So don't rely on anyone else, whether it's a manager or publisher, to further your career, and make sure you're working on it yourself as well. My last takeaway was that building your career is all about consistency, and the big wins really relate to the small steps. So make sure that you are working on your music every day, even if it's just a little bit at a time, and you will find yourself moving forward. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.